Okay, we're at 18. Briefly, we came from, led to 17 last week that was discussing, this kind of 18 continues in the discussion of the woes against Babylon. And last week there was a lot of discussion about the kings and the power struggles and they make war against the land in verse 14. And he'll be the Lord of Lords and the King of Kings. That phrase is going to come up again when we get over to 19. So it's reversed, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. But it's a definite reference against Domitian. That was his phrase he had on the side of his horse and he had on the side of his battle chariot and everything else. So it was definitely a reference against Rome. And now we're at 18.
Yeah, bumper stickers then?
Bumper stickers, yeah. Dog is my co-pilot. He had one of those in there. And Nuke the Whales, which is my all-time favorite bumper sticker from the 70s. And they're trying to get rid of nukes and save the whales. And some genius came up with Nuke the Whales. That's still my favorite bumper sticker. I wish I had one. Still today.
So like today's Bible verse from the U Bible app.
Yep.
I ask only one thing, Lord. That I live in your house every day of my life to see how wonderful you are and to pray in your temple.
David wrote that.
That is a Psalms 27:4.
And I don't know David wrote
that. Well, that's the contemporary English version.
It sounds like English, but it also
even Solomon.
Okay.
Could have been Solomon.
Could have been. Could have been Asaph, but it's
Asaph. But it is David.
Good. So we're gonna probably get close to the Hallelujah in 19, but let's start in 18:1. I remember now we've kind of had this cascading flow of angels that are giving these declarations are coming down. They're not specifically described. They're not in a, this is not a flow of like any of the bowls or trumpets or seals. We're past that. We're past all of those series of sevens. And now we're getting very close to the end. I saw another angel coming out from heaven. He had great authority. And the earth was illuminated by his splendor, and with a mighty voice he shouted, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a home for demons, a haunt for every evil spirit, a haunt for every unclean, detestable bird, for all the nations of dark matter, maddened one for adultery." That reference, of course, pulling across the last couple of chapters. And the kings of the earth committed adultery with her. That's a reference back to the last chapter, all the discussions about the kings and the ten kings and the horns and all of that. And the merchants of the earth will grow rich from her excessive intrigue. The rest of this chapter pretty much is about a crown. And the kings get mentioned down here in verse 9. But the rest of this is a setup to talk about the economic, the richness of Rome. And of course, that had been true of Babylon. And John, one of the commentaries I read said, just imagine the irony of this. You've got this old, green, condemned prophet who's been put out on an island in exile. And he's going to write about the fall of the greatest empire in the history of the world.
400 years before it happened.
Before it happened. Then I heard another voice from heaven say, "Come out of her, my people." So there's still people. "So that you will not share in her sins, so that you will not receive any of her plagues. For her sins are piled up to heaven. God has remembered her crime. Give back to her as she has given. Pay her back double for what she has done." Very common reference all through the prophets that there would be a double portion, as it says, a double portion from their own cup. the payback is twice as bad as the original. Give her as much torture and grief as the glory and luxury she gave herself. What an interesting thing that is. Give over the glory and the luxury, and give her as much torture and grief. In her heart she goes, I sit as queen. I'm not a widow, and I will never mourn. Give the bride of that. Therefore, in one day, her plagues will overtake her, death, mourning, famine. She'll be consumed by fire, for money is the Lord who judges her. Now, the interesting reference there to Rome being consumed by fire, this is years, decades after the great fire of Rome and Nero, which, of course, is blamed on the Christian, even though most scholars think Nero had somebody's life for him. He was not the actual arson who went out with a torch in his own hand, but he hired some ruffians to go light the cheap part of town that was close to the forum area that he wanted to build some of his things, and that got out of hand and just went rampant through the city. And he's like, the Christians, yeah, they did it. Yeah, it was them. That's the ticket. So it's interesting, the idea of the fire consuming Rome. And when the kings of the earth who committed adultery with her shared her luxury, see the smoke of her burning, they'll weep and mourn over her, terrified of her torment, they'll stand far off and cry, woe, woe, O great city, O Babylon, city of power, in 1 hour your doom has come. I never saw anything that was a specific significance to the 1 hour idea. We've heard that twice now. I was wondering about that. I think it's just more a matter of things are going along and then it just turns on a dime and the whole thing crumbles.
And this was 400 years later?
Yeah, in 400 when the Goths and Visigoths came in and sacked Rome. It literally was, it happened almost unexpectedly. They were not prepared for what happened, for sure. But it's also interesting that so many of these kings respond because, of course, Rome had figured out a way to have a lot of political allies with a lot of different countries around the world. And they considered Rome a benefit, because of trade and because of a lot of the things that they weren't going to get defeated and kicked around by the opposition. Yeah, they were usually a benefit. Now look at this list. And the merchants, hey, welcome. No problem. We talked about you behind your back. But referencing back off of verse 3, where it says the kings of the earth committed adultery and the merchants of the earth be rich and their excessive luxuries. This picks up here. Verse 1 picks up off of the merchants. No, weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargo. That's a simple economic scenario. Cargoes of gold, silver, precious stones, pearls, fine linen, purple, silk, scarlet cloth, every sort of citron, articles of every kind made of ivory, costly wood, bronze, iron, marble, cargoes of cinnamon, spice, incense, myrrh, frankincense, wine, olive oil, fine flour, wheat, cattle, sheep, horses, carriages, bodies, and souls of men. Let's walk through that list a little bit. First of all, do you find a little interesting that it's this detail?
Yeah.
This mine says slaves and other humans.
And that's really what Biden and souls of men is about, slave trade. So this thing progressively goes through typical luxuries and it works itself down to things all the way to the most insidious one, which is slavery. Pliny, who was a famous historian from this time period, wrote about 27 luxuries. He actually put together a massive shopping list with the histrionic of every one of those, that's where they came from, what it took to get them to Rome. Because of these things, almost none of them are even in Italy, much less near Rome. Some marble, they could get some marble that was close. But of course, the marble that was close to them, which some of the Carrara marble is the greatest marble in the world, they hardly used it because it was too easy. It was cheap. They could get it. So what they did was import marble from Morocco, from India, and from places all around the planet. This list, as Pliny went through this list, almost all of the 27 he wrote about are in the house of Pliny. And he went through all of what it took to get these from the far reaches of the planet, from China. The Romans thought that silk literally grew in trees in China. Like the trees spun the silk. They didn't know that there were worms that actually spun the webs. The Romans thought it just grew on silk trees in China. They didn't even have to know where this stuff came from. But all they knew was the wine for the trees of the world. And they could get it. They built several ports on either the west and the east side of the boot, near Rome, that were just importing places for luxuries. Many of them hardly put anything in it, was just to survive. It was all luxury.
So there was maritime trade back then?
They were the greatest maritime traders, and in fact, from now through Diocletian, and then Constantine changed a lot of the impact of the trade. For the next couple hundred years, they're the greatest maritime traders, and nobody comes close for 1,200 years.
That just blows my mind. I like that technology. And then think about this list. We take it for granted that we get it at Walmart.
And well, I think this is a good time to talk about that.
Thank you.
So you look at these things. Now, it gets down to the work itself, to trade, to slave trade. This is a big deal. We have trade students in the group. We have gotten rid of the slave trade. We have done that. But thinking about luxury, the last thing I saw was that the 20% of the world were the rich. Which of course the middle class Americans are easily in the top 12-15% of the world. And I'm talking rich Americans, I'm talking rich Americans. I mean the poor in this country. The last one I saw, which was from like 2005, so it's a little bit older, like 83% of the resources of the world are used by 20% of the world's population. And that number, thankfully, the things I just read this morning when I was looking at some of this, the numbers within the last 5 to 7 years have been coming back. In other words, the underpopulated world is actually gaining ground in wealth development, and the rich part of the world is losing. That's actually good news. But we're so far out of being that good that, we're a million miles from being here. The majority of the world has access to, close to the wealth of the world. And of course, the vast majority of it, just like this, comes from other places in the world, and then we can see it.
What's your point?
I'll ask you to make a point.
You're making me uncomfortable.
Yes, I suppose I am.
But you know, China and Russia are coming from being third world countries and being first world countries, and they are huge in population. We're 330 million, and China's now 1.4 billion, and India's
over a billion.
Close to a billion. Just moving them out of agricultural into manufacturing, and unfortunately they are consuming raw materials and polluting in just crazy ways. There is no potable water in China. We just have huge, all the rivers are polluted, it's just terrible. So their survival is difficult. That water is going to be the biggest. Oil's not going to be our problem. It's not going to be our problem.
I'd say that for a long time. That's a new goal. What do you think about, we are part of the richest, most consumer-oriented population. This group of planet alone, they look like nothing compared to anybody in just common middle-class neighborhood. I'm not talking Hollywood, Manhattan. I'm talking just simple America.
Well, subtly, what it does, it creates the illusion that we have everything here on Earth. We're heaven on Earth. We don't want to give up. And individuals think about dying, I don't want to leave this because I've got so much. And so that's a secular kind of a feeling that undermines hope for, developing country like Haiti. Their hope is that it's going to be better and they can't get there soon enough. So I guess that's the dichotomy.
How do we know if we have enough?
It's insatiable.
That's a good
I'm choking on the word. It reminds you of the welfare state. How much is enough? No matter how much you give, they want more. Aren't we all like that? Is that human nature? I don't know.
You know that since Tom Katie left, I've had 30 people ask us when we're going to move upstairs from the basement. People somehow feel really bad about really being a very nice apartment. And I don't know, I literally have been scratching my head, like, am I sending off some kind of signal to you? Like, I'm not happy with you? Because if that's the case, that's not what I feel. But it's possible I'm actually projecting something like that, you know. But if that's not the case, then why are people worried about us when we're fine? I'm warm, I have hot showers, we have a refrigerator with food in it.
Because they want you to have more.
Maybe they love you that much that they want you to be comfortable and happy and the opportunity is there, so they'd like you to have it.
And that's an interesting thing, because what if it's enough for us to be in the basement? I mean, is that a loss? Do we need to?
Sounds like a sort of thing.
if you refer to that basement, but I say it as a lower level.
Here in the lower level.
All right, you sacrificed and you downsized, and now that you've been upsized, everybody assumes that you want to.
Yeah, interesting. I don't think it's a bad idea to upsize, but it is. Is that like a demand? Is that like a requirement? Is that what everybody should be known for?
Peter Principle in a different way.
They were going to ask me to supersize.
My family's gone just the opposite because, and it's really from, I can't take all the credit for it, but.
We give Lee very little. We give Lee and most of it.
As a builder, you relate to, we start out with what we can afford. And then we realize as we get successful, hey, we can, actually after failure too, we know it's a divorce, but
It's just what I do as a builder. I look for a land that's improvable, and then I build it, and I build as much as the bank will allow me to do it now. So we went through a foreclosure. I don't have any desire to go through that again. Just to see that when we built 5,000 square feet on a lake with a private dock and a private boat, and then all the homes around us are million-dollar homes, and we lived there for 10 years, and then what we designed and we're on our hands and knees building and doing all this work for ourselves, and we got to live there for 10 years. But it was for ourselves. It wasn't for resale, which it should have been, if I was thinking before the economy tanked. I would have thinking, oh, I've got to get, you know, gotta sell this thing. Can't afford to live here. And so now downsizing makes perfect sense. Maybe 1,200 square feet. Like we could live in 800 square feet if we had to afford us. We talked about living in a two-bedroom instead of a three-bedroom. We still don't know where we're going to be in 3 weeks. But the living situation really rings a bell for me because we haven't moved so much since we've been here.
Let's talk about one little two-word thing you said in there. You said the economy. We all think that, but how much, you know, we live in vacation? What does the economy think?
For me, it meant taking small
rocks. Yeah, I'm not throwing rocks at you.
No.
Because that's kind of the common reference point. 2008 was like a tragic event with this dude in the United States. How many people lost even hardly a step in living the lifestyle that we live? It was the most luxurious lifestyle. This thing has become, in my mind, a necessity.
There were a lot of people, especially those in the financial realms, they got their living in homes and real estate, finance. There was a long period of time where there was just no business to be done. And if that's how you earned your living, you suffered. Now, were you, did you get knocked, you know, into the mud, or did you get knocked off a high perch down to a regular reality?
Even a regular merchant in the United States in the 21st
century. Well, if you want the statistics, you know, the definition of a recession is 3 or more quarters of negative GDP growth. Okay, so gross domestic product, which is the output of the United States goods and services, grows on average at a rate of between 2 and 3% every year, and it's like negative for 2 years. Which is actually most recessions over the last year, 2 or 4 years, so it lasted a full 2 years. And the worst we got to was a negative 4.3% loss rate as opposed to growth rate. So we went down by 4%.
4%.
Right.
Now 40%.
Right. And we lost 3.1 million jobs. Okay. Out of 330 million people, so 1% of all the people all of a sudden who are working out be employed because you've got kids who are unemployed and stuff like that. You know, the employment as a percentage was down by 3% or something. So it seems pretty small, right? It obviously depends on how big thing, and that's what we hear in the news. But you're right, most of us lose our jobs. And our savings for retirement went down instead of up. And all the jobs that were lost got recovered by mid-year last year. And since then, we've been back in growth mode. And the population growth rate actually slowed from now 0.9% to 0.72%. And now it's moved back up.
That's what we need to know. We, you think in all of those kind of numbers, just a big actual impact on how much of this life. You know, in 1900,
only 16% of the population have the capacity to quit their jobs at 65. And they're supported by their own wealth for the rest of their life. 1900, 16%. Now it's 67%.
But the statistics that goes with that is 1900, only 20% of people live in cities. About the rest were out of agriculture. And so the family lived on the farm, and the kids and the parents worked, and the grandparents took care of the kids. And, you know, in other words, they brought you up, they took care of you. And then when they got older, you kind of took care of that place with the stuff in the house.
And the other thing is, the good news is, you good long enough, I guess, to get to 65 gallons, is you're not going to live that long.
The average age in 1900. Yeah, there's lifespan in 1900, it's 40 years old.
Yeah, that was like that. So I didn't know you were doing that.
No. And it just hit 80. Mm-hmm. For the last decade, it's been 71. Just hit 80.
So even one of the lucky ones would happen.
Yes, I guess that's a lot.
To consume more.
To consume more. Got
that going on.
Very much as expected.
Yes.
And be grateful. Just live that. You know, I live that every morning. Just like, I look out my window and see that sun coming in. Mountain behind the golf course there.
That's when we say grace at a meal and recognize that others don't have it. And we have to feel that we need to fast because they don't. No, I think that's where it's kind of coming into what is entitlement, and what is earned, and what is appreciated, and all of those kind of words.
I've been guilty of this probably my whole life, is having instead of looking for the retirement and thinking about after 65, I'm thinking about today. I'm looking at my daily bread. I'm thankful for that. I look at what I have and look around me at what others don't have. I feel much more fortunate for them rather than looking at everything that other people have and say, gee, I wish I could have that. I try to pinch myself.
I wanted us to just kind of hang out and see if it's very much better. That can keep it. Few chapters, you can see how it's out of the coast. There's a few people spend a great deal of time just listening to the ships. Just like it's a mystical thing. I don't think it got ever convinced. There's a lot of condemnation about religions because of the fucking attitude.
That's the best way.
The guy who talked about what puts in proper place in the ministry.
So you go to a country where the Bible stands for a verb and what you say. Self isn't bad, it's the attitude that you're talking about. It's the condemnation. So is it as simple as sacrificial giving? That goes a long way toward fixing crummy attitudes?
That's a good question. Fixing is a good, interesting word that I don't know.
Addressing.
Right. Is there a percentage? You know, if you give this much, is that I don't know. This is one of those tensions.
I think it's a heart. I think it's an attitude of gratitude. It's an attitude of gratitude.
Yeah.
So if you have that thankful heart, you can't be too focused on what you don't have.
Yeah, but let's not. What I don't want us to do is focus so much into the mindset that we. And the actual behavior. Mm-hmm. We behave, and even if we're grateful, or if we have good attitudes and we're not mean to our neighbor, but if we behave poorly, we still behave poorly. And is behaving into riches, gaining more riches, having more wealth, is there a behavior that needs to be repented? Or is it okay for us just to pursue wealth endlessly throughout our entire life with never an end? And as long as we have a good attitude, we can consume it and pursuing and consuming. I'm asking, that was in a question form. I'm not making a declaration. I do want us to say, we can't just go to, well, it's just what you think about, but then you can behave however the heck you want, as long as your attitude. You know better.
Well, doesn't the Bible talk about planting good seed?
Right. That's pretty metaphorical, though. I'm trying to be pretty practical here. I don't want to go too metaphorical. That's what I'm trying to get us away from.
Well, God created the earth for our enjoyment
and our responsibility.
I talked about this with my ex-father-in-law just recently, that like, you know, God, I think, you know, and I haven't actually read it, I just, what I've heard, but he asked us to tithe 10%. Right, is that correct? No?
Tithing means 10%.
Okay, so giving 10%.
And that was the Old Testament structure, that was a 10%.
That actually came from the booty of a conquest. Mm-hmm.
Well, the first reference we have is
first
Abraham.
Well, my point was, me and him were talking about this, like God doesn't need our money, he's God.
Right, okay.
So is it the fact, you know, to me, this is how I see it, he does want us to do that, no matter if it's like, okay, it's this church, or maybe it's this that I give to, or maybe it's this. It doesn't matter, it's just like, I want you to give my kingdom because I want you to have status. I want you to know that it's not all about, this is not all about you.
Well, I think the other part of that also is that God wants us to be part of the mission. So he entrusts us with with resources, with money, with, you know, whatever else comes with resources. And then he says, all right, I'm just going to, you know, help kick this off. Let's set 10% as a, you know, as a starter. But he wants that. He wants us to be part of giving that away and watching the redemption that happens.
But doesn't it also require that it be done joyfully?
Well, that's the whole thing too, right? So, like, not doing it based off of, like, legalism, but doing based off of it that God has great intentions for
us. I made 10,000 this month. Here's your 1,000, God. And then I'm taken care of at that point. Because, and it's even mentioned that, it might be wrong, but your good works and the filthy rags in the eyes of the Lord.
And that's just my personal opinion. Like, I feel like he wants us to do that because he wants us, like, and to do it, like, joyfully, because, like, we know that God is for us and not against us. So his intention for that is good. And so we, you know, doing it joyfully, and it will, you know, have you, you know, I feel like, you know, just having it'll maybe create maybe a little bit better attitude about it.
And then we'll throw another curve on it. So we joyfully is a big part, our attitude is a big part. Remember in the last week, Jesus is in the temple and he sees a widow come in and she drops in 2 pennies, right? And Jesus huddles the guy and says, see all these other guys coming in here, putting stuff in? And then her, who gave the most, right? You know that story. Mm-hmm. So it's not just about giving with a cheerful or with a happy to be involved. There's the sacrificial aspect, right? So if you're an American, 10% of your income for an average American, it's a piece of cake.
Right.
That's an easy deal. It costs us, we will not miss a meal. We won't miss a second's worth of a tank of gas. We won't have any less heat in our home. We'll have all of our cable bills paid. We'll still live in a very nice house. You see what I'm saying?
So that a sacrificial giving where I can only go to Hawaii rather than a European bonanza
right.
is not sacrificial giving. Exactly. Sacrificial giving might actually look a little bit like a fasting scenario.
It might. I'm not trying to be a legalist and turn us back into that, but if there is that attitude, it is not about trying to equalize like I literally can accomplish that.
Yeah, it's not about works.
But it is about the idea that some kind of something that costs me, I love the story of David, who would sacrifice something that didn't cost him. David had a plan that he was going to pay. And of course, the guy said, whoa, you can use my things for sacrificing. I'm happy to give them to you. And he was like, no, I'm okay. So at least cost me something. Yeah. I think it's worth it. We could hardly talk about this enough.
I heard an interesting thing on, exciting on Friday. This guy, Brian Lee, ministers on KLTT, said take, I think he said 10%, but. And he said, when you get paid, just go to the bank and take out the 10% in cash. He said, get one of those big staplers and staple the cash all together and put it someplace and start praying about where God wants you to put that money. And until you hear from God, leave it there.
He suggested that you do it.
To him, yeah, right. And leave it there until you know clearly, you have a clear, you know, passion in your heart. Who gets that? What ministry gets it, or what orphanage gets it, or what, you know, widow gets it, but who gets it?
Well, we might as well dispel the 10%. Let's just do that right now. Because the standard that Paul uses in 1 Corinthians 8 and 9 is actually the standard for the spirit-led giving. Has nothing to do with 10%. 10% is Testament model, which is based off of Abraham. It's carried through first fruits, often way higher than 10%, even for Jews in the Old Testament. 10% is an absolute number, but the percentage has nothing to do with the final design question. Again, it's what are the needs of people around you that you can move the power style provided to you in the future. So whether that's 1% this week or 100% next week, that's the critical measure. 10% is just, it's a nice reference. But it's, honestly, if we believe, especially as Americans, in this time period, we believe that that's really all we know about.
And none of the money and the goods that we have are, we're custodians. That's where it's on loan. Like Russia's talent on loan from God. And anything that we give for God is just returned to us. Stuff.
Well, the thing up there, this book doesn't get to a whole lot of contrast between the issues we really have to study James. But I think it's something that we need to take ownership of. Staying, if you think you get to an easy, settled place as to where this goes, like, oh, now I got this covered, that's probably the most dangerous spot you can be. When you talk about the tensions of how a lot of this works theologically, we have practical behavior that we need to behave into as far as management of our life. And, often what we're actually trying to manage now is debt. It has nothing to do with wealth. We've already behaved into the wealth long before we actually even have the resources for it. Our whole culture is built like that now. That thing, is there any ideas? Does anybody, I point to you because you work in that. And you teach in the culture of finances. Is there any idea how sustainable it is for us to be such a highly wealth built off of debt culture? I mean, how long can that go? Does anybody talk about that?
I mean, when you look at the debt of our nation, you know, and it's actually doubled in the past 7 years.
And how does that even be possible?
I know, and that's, well, actually, you know, one of the major ways that it's possible is the fact that we crammed interest rates down so low that paying our national debt used to take 20% of the budget. And with lower interest rates, that dropped to 5%. So they said, well, then we can just lend more money. And the fact that, I mean, our Congress is the most
irresponsible.
Yeah, you know, because they just keep piling more on, and you hear in the news all the time. You know, we're spending our children's inheritance. You know, our children's inheritance. We're keeping it up so that we can live the good life, and eventually, you know, Rome's going to fall again. I mean, when we did that 90 days through the Bible, my concept, you know, my takeaway was, okay, you're with the chosen people. 40 years, okay, you screwed up, you're dead. Okay, next. Okay, now it's your turn, right? And he just gave it to different cultures, and they blow it up, and they'd be gone, and he'd move on to the next one. On and on and on. So here we are. We've run 200 years. But, you know, we're the next England, right? We're not going to be the superpower. And maybe in my lifetime, we're no longer going to be the superpower of the earth.
September of this year. So we are done. $18 trillion debt. We're going up a trillion every year. When Reagan was around, everybody got excited because we had $400 billion in debt. Now we've got $18 trillion. We are so far. We have 20 generations couldn't pay back what we got now. We're that far gone. This country is walking dead. We are utterly in control of the people at the very top who are managing this balloon. If you watch what happened in 2008, being a banker, I watched it happen. The government pushed on the banks to make bad loans. Mm-hmm. They leaned on. We had a guy who was called a small business unit. He was a black guy who ran a unit that was ordered to make bad loans that we knew we'd never get paid back because we wanted the feds to allow us to have branches and to buy other banks. That's how they had us. And we made bad loans. We all knew they weren't getting paid back. It was a cost of doing business. Take that concept and stick it into where the government forced banks bad loans to people who could not afford houses. That was when all in the aura of it's the American dream, yada yada. Pump the damn thing up as far as you can go. The banks look said, oh my gosh, look at this crap we have on our balance sheets. We got to do something. Hey, let's securitize. We make packages of it, sell it into the market. And the word on the street was back to everybody. They'll default on everything but never on your house. So mortgages are the safest thing you can do. And the whole market took that up. And they're packaging trillions of dollars in bad loans. And then the pinion, actually on the sheet of that, obviously, which was actually to the day from 2001 recession, to the day. And we're approaching that this September. This September is coming.
Why is it
7 years?
It's the sheet of year. That's another whole thing.
No, I kind of know about that. I've never, especially going through Revelation, but it's not knowing how to...
Historically, how, you can how, see it, though.
I know, but I'm not sure how to respond to that, given a lot of warnings about how to think about prophetic words in the Bible and what they mean. Because I definitely been plugged into some of what you've been talking about. I just am not sure what to do with it.
Yeah.
Well, regardless, it's not sustainable forever.
And that 18 trillion,
like, 7 years, it's 8 years, and 6 years.
The 18 trillion is nothing. The unfunded liabilities with Social Security and retirement, but now we're pushing 100 trillion.
No country could ever do what we did because we were a reserve currency.
That's the only reason.
Exactly.
That's the whole thing. We had hyperinflation.
Petrol dollars. The Arabs accept payment in dollars for oil. The minute they say, that's it, we're taking the Chinese renminbis, it's over. Because we have to buy renminbis first before we can get our oil. We are walking dead. It's just a matter of when you want to pull the trigger. It's over, guys.
So, let's party. Is that what we should do? That's the question.
No.
What do we want to be? Let's say the thing is going to, the flood's going
to
pull.
You live your life to the best you can in God's, according to God's commands. Worship Him, follow Him, keep your eye on Him, trust in Him, trust in the Lord Jesus. No matter what happens, remember that's what matters, not that. What we have.
But our behaviors matter. I'm going to keep going back to that. So do we just keep consuming?
Well,
is that what we do? We just, no. While it's still alive, we just keep consuming? While it's still going, it's somebody else's problem? I'm not even trying to answer that question. That's not my goal. My goal is to at least ask it, because the truth is, the church is already talking about this. That's it. Because it's the biggest elephant in the room that we've got. Mm-hmm. It is the elephant. And it's the elephant in the corner yesterday. I looked around in that room. It was a ball. It was a great celebration of the resurrection. It was upbeat. It was fun. It was everything. And still look at the riches, right? And so, like, is it the riches that get us there? Because I tell you, we could have nothing, right? We could literally have nothing. We could still have a celebration. But do we even think about that? Do we think, no, we need to put some bigger speakers back there? or whatever the heck happens is in our American minds, like, that TV vendor could be 120 inches instead of, you know what I mean? This is what we keep doing, right? Because we have the capacity.
There are huge numbers of Americans that think that. And the farther we move away from God, the more we think about that. But the people around here, from my humble observation, aren't afflicted with that as much as everyone else. Let's say we're all open more now. But God has blessed this country beyond belief. And what we need to do is understand that, show our appreciation, take care of it. I have a hard time feeling terrible that I did okay. And I didn't do okay compared to being you and being you. Now, some of my classmates from college are eons wealthier than I'll ever dream about being. But that's not the point of it. With my humble researches, I am so happy here. And I'm so happy that God has blessed me so much. I thank Him every day. And I do what I can. And I keep that attitude. And I keep Jesus in front of me all the time. And somehow, if we were all have an attitude where we focus on God instead of on the wealth. But we're so far past that, I'm using hope for this country. It's over. It's just a question of time.
Well, I suppose that's probably true, that there is, I mean, every great power has their own force. And so there is a, and we should just know that we're in a real tangible force, a real tangible resources and limitations. I think it's worth us having a discussion to talk about our attitudes about it, what we have, we want to see this game, what we want to
do. I think that's going to be very good.
By the history, Sam, we love you the most of the gentry, most of the aristocrats, most of the economic, just the health care, just the electricity. Hardly on the wildest dreams of the richest men across the country. Just do that. And so somehow, yes, our attitude needs to be right, and somehow our behavior needs to be right. That's our real thing. That's our thing. And, you know, I just don't want us to just keep going through this book. And if we have opportunities to stop and talk about some of the injunctions, some of the warnings, some of the here's one. Babylon, Rome, America. There's no way we could put ourselves in the category of the poor. We're in the category of Babylon, Rome, and what does that mean in light of all this strange prophecy? I can't tell you that. I'm not saying we are. It should say, war to you, Lord, but it should be more. But you could write that in. You could. That's all. We need to keep talking about it because it's such a big part of our reality. And the last thing is to hear people whining about, I don't have, I'm underserved, I don't, you know. We need to dispel that. And we also need to dispel the idea that we're so poor off because we don't know the world of life except here. Alright. Well, that's it. We're done today. Well, we got through there. We'll pick up there after that. Sea captains. And we'll keep plowing through. We might get into the Hallelujahs in 19 next week. I think we will. But we'll spend bucks time on that. So think about it. If you have any comments related to wealth management.
Hey, Mike. Sorry, guys.
Yeah, Mike. Oh, you're good.
Have any comments related to wealth management?
Well, the word I didn't hear come up is stewardship. We are supposed to be good stewards.
Yeah, I think it was mentioned earlier. Yeah, I think it was. Just that idea that we're just managers. We're not really
owners.
That's right. Custodians.
Yeah, we're stewards of debt, unfortunately.
Both wealth and debt.
We are.
Yeah, we are.
That's good. Good stuff.